right. Please be seated. Good morning, everyone. This morning we have Waupun High School with us. If you could stand, please. It's great to have you here today, court with class, so you've studied up a little bit. After our arguments, Rebecca Dallet will have the opportunity to talk with you if you're able to stay. And you can ask her anything you'd like. She really likes answering tough questions, so go right ahead and do that. Thank you for coming. We appreciate you being here. Go ahead and have a seat. All right, then this morning's case is State versus Jackson. It's 20 AP 2119 CR. Could I please start out with just your appearances?
Appearing for the defendant appellate petitioner, Larry L. Jackson.
Morning. Good morning. All right, I just like to make sure we're all on the same page. So starting out with 25 minutes, 30 minutes of argument, followed by 5 minutes of rebuttal, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead and proceed.
May it please the court, I guess I've already introduced myself. I wanted to actually, before I kind of get into my argument in general, I wanted to address, we have an amicus brief. Of course, that was not addressed in my briefs. I read that, and at the end of it, I said, darn, I wished I had written that. I was a little chagrined by some of the things that I wish I had said that they had said, specifically about the Jenkins case. I do feel that maybe I was... maybe I was conflating some different concepts of believability versus credibility, and I wish that where I was saying credibility, I was actually saying believability. I specifically also wanted to maybe draw the court's attention to, I read over Jenkins, I read it carefully, and I was really struck by something actually the concurring opinion had to say, Justice Crooks, and he talks about, you know, how you apply the principles in that case, you know, in a practical matter for the trial judge. And I specifically would draw the attention to paragraph 23. I'm going to go ahead and read it because it is going to factor into my argument today. He says, a proper application of the above legal principles to the facts of this case would require the circuit court to consider the following questions in assessing whether trial counsel's error failing to call Jones, and Jones was an uncalled alibi witness, much like we have here in this case, we have two uncalled alibi witnesses. And in determining or assessing whether trial counsel's error in failing to call this witness prejudiced the defendant, we should ask, one, was Jones's testimony within the realm of believability in light of the totality of the circumstances in the case? And two, was Jones's testimony materially beneficial to the defendant's theory of the case? And then he goes on in the next paragraph saying, you know, I feel if, you know, you limit your inquiry to these questions, you know, you would correctly reserve questions of credibility and significance of the Jones testimony to the jury. This strikes me as being correct. I'm perfectly fine, particularly in my client's case, that would be the way to approach it. That's always sort of been my impression, was that it wasn't Mr. Jackson's burden to show that the jury absolutely would have found his witnesses to be more credible than the state's, but that they were at least within the realm of believability, sufficient that it undermines confidence in the verdict that was rendered. Now, there was another thing about the Jenkins case that kind of struck me, was that was also an identification case, much like Mr. Jackson's. And we have a similarity in that in Jenkins, the court says, the entire basis of the prosecution's case rested on eyewitness identification. All the state witnesses had some issues with their credibility, and there was no physical or other evidence that directly tied the defendant to the crime.
Mr. Beckel, can I ask something about, in Jenkins, they held a Mockner hearing.
No, we did not have a Mockner hearing. And that's my issue is that
in Jenkins?
Oh, in Jenkins, I believe they did have a Mockner hearing.
Right.
Jenkins is not strictly speaking about having a Mockner hearing. They had a Mockner hearing in Jenkins.
It was an ineffective assistance. It was the next step, right?
Yeah, they went the next step. All I'm asking really here today is give me the hearing, you know?
Well, right. So that's
So John Allen is obviously the principal case we're dealing with.
Okay. So I spent a lot of time last night with Jenkins, too, and I understand what the amicus is asking us. I mean, I read their brief to say that what they want us to do is explain that unless a witness's proffered testimony is incredible as a matter of law, a circuit court may not itself assess a witness's credibility or the credibility of their proffered testimony to deny the motion without a hearing. I understand that. I'm not sure that you're asking us for that test, but I don't. My understanding is the issue right now in this case is whether or not the motion for a Mockner hearing was sufficient on its face.
Yes, that is exactly the issue we're hearing.
Okay, and my understanding of the law is that we are to look at the motion and the affidavits that are attached to the motion and assume that everything in there is true.
That would be exactly my position.
So why then, this is where I got confused last night, and it might have been because it was at the end of a really long day, but then why do we even need to worry about credibility right now if we are just looking at the motion and the affidavits and assuming that everything in them is true?
Well, I think you're correct. I mean, we are to assume everything that is alleged in there is true, but the Court of Appeals went in there and they said, well, you know, we look at the totality, the record that was made at a trial, because there was a trial here. And they're saying that looking at the evidence that was presented at the trial, I think they're basically saying that nobody could possibly believe my alibi witnesses. That's the only way I figure that we can say that there's no way I could prove prejudice, because that's basically, as I understood the Court of Appeals' opinion, was that they were saying I would never be able to prove prejudice, even if I have a Mockner hearing. And I think that there are a lot of reasons to believe that there would have been prejudice. Now, I mean, you know, anything could happen at the Mockner hearing, of course. But
so what are you asking us to have as a principle of law that comes out of this case?
Well, I would say that you can't go ahead and say nobody can, you know, that a witness cannot, an alibi witness, an uncalled alibi witness, should not be declared to be unbelievable, that nobody could possibly believe this without at least giving me a chance to, you know, present my witness to the court. I mean, these people were... My alibi witness, uncalled alibi witnesses are being rejected unheard.
So you're just asking us to do what's like in State v. Love, right? When assessing a sufficiency of a motion's objective, material, factual assertions of prejudice to require a hearing based on a counsel's failure to call certain witnesses, the court must assume that the substance of the proffered testimony is true. That's just what you're asking us to do, right?
Yes, and I think that is exactly what I'm at. If my uncalled alibi witnesses are telling the truth, then Larry Jackson was innocent, you know? And what we have here is we have two banks of witnesses who are testifying to him being at different places. We have the state's witnesses who says they were at the house of the victim and Gerald Tucker, and that he came down the sidewalk and went into the doorway, turned around, and shot the victim, R.K. And then we have three witnesses, two of whom were uncalled, Larry Jackson's mother, his sister, and his girlfriend at the time, who say, no, he was at his mother's house during that entire period. And if they're telling the truth, then he's not guilty of the crime.
Is there also an issue, I don't know, as I read this, it seemed really murky to me as to whether or not the defense attorney actually tried to subpoena Crystal and Marsh. Is that also an issue for the Mockner hearing, in your opinion?
It may well be. It may well end up being a big issue at the Mockner. We have not heard from the trial attorney.
And the trial attorney could also say, I made a choice to call the mom. I chose not to call the girlfriend and the sister because I thought the mom was more credible. And that could be a strategical reason that the attorney chose to do what she did.
It's possible, but I would respond to that by saying, I don't see how you make that determination without talking to the witnesses
first.
Right.
So you have to have a Mockner hearing, though,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Well, maybe she did try. We have no idea.
You know, it may surprise, but trial attorneys are not always fully cooperative with appellate counsel. I'm not saying that was the case here, but sometimes I really don't.
You might not have to.
Sometimes I really don't know exactly. You know, I don't really find out what the trial attorney was thinking until I actually get them on the stand under oath and I can ask questions. And that is, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely correct. This whole thing could blow up in a Mockner hearing. You know, I mean, that's happened to me before. But I don't think that's going to be the case. And the other thing I would just respond to saying that is that, I mean, you know, even Strickland talks about that if there's an investigation, the failure to call a witness is virtually unassailable, is what the court said in Strickland. But that changes when you fail to have an investigation. If you don't even talk to the witness, how do you determine that this other witness, mom, is more credible? And you know, let's be honest. I mean, mom, everybody expects mom to testify to the alibi. You know, the ex-girlfriend, maybe not so much. But the other thing is that three alibi witnesses in and of itself is better than having one. And the other thing about the two uncalled ones is they would have corroborated many elements of Carol Jackson's testimony and cleared up some of the negative things that happened during mom's testimony.
Does the record reflect how old Crystal is? Is she an adult?
Yeah, I believe she's an adult. I don't know if the record reflects it right now or
okay.
not. But I believe, and I, she was at the time.
I understand we have other affidavits here, but follow me on this hypothetical for a moment. Let's take Janika out of the picture for just a minute. So you have Carol's daughter, Crystal, at home, right, with Mr. Jackson. That's the allegation here. If the attorney had planned to call Mr. Jackson, did call Carol, but say didn't have any kind of extensive conversation with Crystal, I guess I was never contacted by the attorney or law enforcement, is what the affidavit says. Do you think that's automatically ineffective assistance of counsel? In other words, how many alibis does one have to, you know, how far do you have to go in the investigation when you say, oh, you've hit the bright line, we're you know, definitely at deficient performance?
Well, you know, I guess that is going to depend upon the totality of the circumstances, and it's going to be different in every case. I did have a case where an attorney chose not to interview child witnesses because he felt they were very young. I disagreed with that, obviously. You know, I feel you need to talk to them. But
yeah.
You know, if he talks to them and then says, this is cumulative evidence, I don't need this, I already got other witnesses saying what I want, and they've actually done an investigation. I mean, if they make that decision, that's going to be virtually unassailable.
I get concerned with some bright line rules in this area. The standard for deficient performance is exceptionally high, and sometimes gets watered down to a bad attorney. A bad attorney is not a constitutionally deficient one. You're only at that level if you're so bad that you can be said to not even have had an attorney. So you can be a really bad attorney and not, you know, be a constitutionally deficient one. And so I get a little concerned with bright line rules. Did investigate a couple of potential alibis. One who was home, we don't know anything else other than that. with Carol, who was called, and with Mr. Jackson, and, you know, another who said, I didn't really want to talk to law enforcement. Yeah, you know, just pondering, are we sure that failure to do that investigation is always, you know, is a matter of law? You didn't talk to these potential alibis, ergo.
I hear what the justice is saying. I do think alibi witnesses are sort of in a different class than yet, you know, another, because an alibi witness, if they're telling the truth, I mean, the defendant is not guilty. I mean, he's innocent if they're telling the truth. And, you know, maybe there's a point where you can say, I don't need the third or, you know, I don't need the fourth or the fifth. But particularly in a situation here where the alibi witnesses are going to corroborate elements and important elements of the testimony of the witness who did testify, I think that's starting to get into deficient performance. Specifically in this case, Carol Jackson, she talks about remembering that on the evening, her son had an argument with his girlfriend, Janika. Well, Crystal confirms that. She says, on that night, Janika and Larry were having an argument. Carol Jackson insists that she knows the events occurred on March 11th, the day of the homicide, because that was the last day she saw Janika. Okay? Janika confirms that was the last time we were there and that this happened, this argument we had happened on the night of the homicide. And that's very important because the most effective part, in my opinion, of the cross, and I think the state, you know, the prosecutor did an excellent cross on Ms. Jackson. I think the most devastating part was the fact that when one of the detectives called her, she was like, I don't know what night this happened on. I just know the time frame of what was going on. I remember watching, was it Jeopardy? I think it was. No, Wheel of Fortune. They were watching Wheel of Fortune. Janika can confirm that was the night of homicide. So she could have corroborated a very important weakness in Carol Jackson's testimony. And I find it interesting that, you know, the state and the lower courts put so much emphasis that certain states corroborate elements of other state witnesses, but they seem to provide no weight at all to the fact that the uncalled alibi witnesses would have corroborated portions of Carol Jackson's testimony. You know, and that gets to prejudice to me.
I don't hear you asking for a per se rule that the failure to call alibi witnesses is per se deficient performance, right? You're asking for the opportunity to have an evidentiary hearing to determine whether in this case the failure to call alibi witnesses was deficient performance and prejudicial to the defendant, right?
I don't need a per se rule. I need a ruling that these witnesses should be allowed to testify. So I'm arguing for what is important for my client, who is Larry L. Jackson, not every defendant in the state of Wisconsin. I understand that the amicus might want you to go further, but I don't need it. I'm not asking for it. You know, another thing I wanted to talk about, because there's a lot of discussion, you know, I went back and reread Carol's testimony about receiving a phone call. You know, Carol testified at the trial that Larry received a phone call, and she later says that she admits that the phone call was from Tiffany Tucker, Gerald Tucker's wife, and, you know, Gerald Tucker was one of the witnesses for the state. In fact, he was directly implicated into this homicide. He was the other guy standing on the porch with the unknown black male. And he is also the guy who had the best, you know, the greatest motive to maybe want to shoot RK. He was the one who was actually having a fight with the victim. Now, I mean, you know, things can sometimes spin out of control. I understand that. But, I mean, he was directly implicated in this homicide, as was another witness for the state, Joe Brown. And those are the two guys who name Larry Jackson. You know, they're the ones who can actually put a name to the person who was up there. Joe Brown, he was found in possession of the murder weapon. So he has, he's implicated into this crime. So there are credibility issues with those two witnesses. The witness for, the other witness, two witnesses, Andre Dorsey, he's off on the side of the yard by a fence. He's looking up, you know, from a distance. It's a short period of time. Person walks on, walks to the door, there's some shooting, a gun, a hand goes outside the door, turns, shoots twice at him. He's taking cover, okay? He says that the unknown black male who came up had a, I believe, a hood. He had a scarf around him. So there were things that you could impeach his, you know, his perception of what was going on. Now, it is, he did identify Jackson in a photo lineup. So, you know, that's a, you know, something that goes his way. The other witness was the victim's wife. She never actually identifies Jackson as being the shooter. She says she didn't actually see the shooter or see a gun. And when she was presented with a photo lineup, she said that she said that two of the five people in the lineup potentially looked like the person that she saw run past her window. And she also later sees him a couple weeks later talking to Gerald Tucker's wife. But she doesn't say that Larry Jackson was the guy. She says he potentially looked like it.
Mr. Bechtel, can we go back to the affidavits for just a second? I want to give you a chance to respond to something that the state has in their brief, and that is regarding the two affidavits of Marsh and of Crystal. And I'm starting on page, the very bottom of page 21, going to 22 of the state's brief. They take issue with those affidavits, and the state says that Marsh's affidavit establishes that she lacked personal knowledge of where Jackson was at the time the victim was shot. And then later on, one paragraph later, they say, similarly, Crystal's affidavit shows that she lacked personal knowledge of Jackson's whereabout at the time RK was shot. I wanted to give you a chance. I'm interested, I guess, in what your response is to both of those assertions, that the affidavits themselves do not show what you are saying.
Well, the state's argument, as I understand it, is that they're saying that Janika's affidavit is insufficient, basically because she fell asleep. The two of them are at the house. Larry takes a shower, as I recall the way she describes it. She had a headache. The two of them go to bed. They fall asleep. Next thing she knows, at 9:30. Larry sits up in the bed. He's in his, you know, boxer shorts and everything. As far as, you know, and it's like, oh my God, we're late. Well, 9:30, of course, is past the time of the shooting. They presumably went to bed before the shooting. The state is assuming that he's basically that he snuck out of bed and went off and shot RK. Now, that is a very worthy area to go on, you know, line of questioning, you know, on cross-examination of the witness. But my point is that it doesn't mean that her testimony is not supporting his alibi. You know, you got to make this assumption that it was plausible that he somehow snuck out of bed. You know, how big was the bed? Were they holding each other? Is she a light sleeper? Is she a deep sleeper? Was she taking medication? We don't know any of that stuff. That's what we would get into in an evidentiary hearing. Is there some reason to find her testimony implausible? But I fully expect that she'll testify, no, he couldn't have gotten out of the bed. We also have the other witness, Crystal. Crystal says, I saw them go in to the bedroom and they did not leave, okay? And if that's the case, I mean, then I guess the suggestion is maybe somehow he snuck out a window or whatever. Again, that may be something that could have been brought up at trial to, you know, bring down her credibility. But it isn't the case. I guess what I would say is, if they showed up at the trial and testified, would their testimony have been admissible? And I think certainly their testimony would have been admissible. They have personal knowledge of the things they have knowledge of. And the things they have knowledge of would have supported Jackson's alibi. You know, I mean, I assume when I go to bed at night that my wife is going to be able to testify that I was there in bed with her. You know, I mean, I don't think we read these things. I think it's a tendentious reading, is I think what
Are
I said in the brief.
Are you abandoning the argument regarding the order of the defendant's testimony?
No, I'm not abandoning that argument.
I haven't heard it yet.
I know, and I see I'm getting limited on time. You know, here's my thing about the order of the argument in terms of prejudice. Look, it's very important in the decision of whether to okay? We don't know, because we haven't heard from the trial attorney exactly what was the trial attorney says happened. What we know is what Jackson and his father say happened. And Jackson and his father say that the trial attorney told him that he would have to testify first, which would be a problem under Brooks, okay? And because it does affect your Sixth Amendment right. And, you know, consider this case specifically. Carol Jackson ended up testifying first. Her testimony did not go well. Jackson may well have wanted to testify after her to clear up things that were in her testimony, but he couldn't because he already waived it, because he was told that he would have to testify first. Now, I had to be honest in the motion. I don't see anything in the record saying that the judge actually said that to him, okay? And what I see are these cryptic remarks. Jackson is, the state rests. Jackson's attorney says, I know the court is aware that we have logistic issues. I don't know what those could possibly be. I'm not saying that it's going to win when we have a hearing, but don't we need to have a hearing to hear what the trial attorney says was said there? And don't we need to have, the judge doesn't even, I see my time is over, so.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Once again, my name is Eric Mullenbach, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. The circuit court did not err by considering the affidavit in light of the record as a whole in this case. This case is not about the court stepping into the jury's role and weighing credibility. Rather, this case is about the circuit court exercising its authority to deny Jackson's post-conviction motion without a Mockner hearing, because the record conclusively shows that Jackson was not entitled to any relief. Again, the circuit
Counsel,
court.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you will. The threshold question as to when someone must hold a Mockner hearing is whether the there's sufficient allegations, if true, would entitle them to relief. We don't get to looking at the record as a whole or until we have that threshold question answered. Am I correct in terms of the method of analysis of a case of this nature?
Yes, and I think as this court specifically stressed in two separate occasions just last term, yes, if the record or if the pleading or the motion does allege sufficient facts that would entitle the defendant to relief, under those circumstances, then the defendant is entitled to a Mockner hearing. But the court also held that that's only half the analysis. The other half of the analysis is if the record conclusively establishes that the defendant is not entitled to relief, then it's within the court's discretion as to whether or not to hold a Mockner hearing. And my contention is the circuit court in this particular case properly found that the record conclusively shows that the defendant is not entitled to relief.
So it's your position that a review of the record prompts the initial question or the initial inquiry of whether facts alleged if true, would entitle them to relief?
Well, no. I think what you need to do is, in this particular instance, I guess we can assume, and the circuit court did assume deficient performance. But in determining whether or not the record conclusively shows, in engaging in that analysis, because the allegation is ineffective assistance of counsel, the court had to take a look at the prejudice prong in this case. And in order to do that, like this court explained in State versus Thiel, in a case like this where ineffective assistance is based on counsel's failure to call a witness, the key question is whether the evidence that was omitted undermines confidence in the outcome of the case, given all the totality of the evidence that was presented at trial. So in order to make that determination, it has to take a look at the totality of the admitted evidence and the totality of the evidence that was admitted, presented to trial to determine whether or not there was, in fact, prejudice in this case. And I believe
given,
that the
given that that's your position, and I understand it, this is where I start to stumble with your argument, is that this case is about, you know, he's saying someone else did it, right? Some other dude did it, right?
Right.
And because that is his defense, these two alibi witnesses are arguably pretty crucial to that, right? There's probably nothing more crucial to a some other dude did it defense than alibi witnesses. So given another fact scenario, I feel like your argument would hold a little more weight, but I'm struggling with that. Can you help me?
I guess I'm not entirely, well, if I'm understanding your question
what
correctly.
What I'm hearing you say is, look, there's so much evidence here
right.
that there is no way that Mr. Jackson here is going to be able to establish prejudice. And what I'm saying is that might be true if his defense were something other than I wasn't there and I've got two alibis, three alibi witnesses,
sure.
only one of whom testified at trial,
yep.
to say that to testify on my behalf saying I was not there. So I feel like that diminishes the strength of the state's case fairly significantly given this fact scenario.
Well, I respectfully disagree with that because the evidence that's the evidence against Jackson in this case was overwhelming, and I'm not contending that the affidavits were false or not worthy of belief per se. What I'm arguing is, again, the evidence was simply overwhelming. And I understand that I recounted a lot of that evidence in my brief, and I won't go through all of that here, obviously, but because the prejudice analysis is necessarily fact dependent, I'd like to highlight a few points of the strengths of this, and that might answer your question a little bit more clearly. In this particular case, there were three different eyewitnesses that testified that Jackson was at the scene of the shooting. Gerald Turner was one of those witnesses who actually ID'd Jackson as the shooter. Andre Dorsey, also an eyewitness, ID'd Jackson as the shooter. And the victim's wife, CW, while she didn't identify Jackson as the shooter, identified him as being present at the scene of the shooting, running past her window. That was at least the tentative identification that she made. In addition to that, there were a total of five witnesses that all testified that Jackson was not at his mother's home, at Carol's home, between the hour of 7:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. And that's critical because this shooting happened right around 8 p.m. So, and I think it's important to understand who those witnesses are. The first witness is Gerald Turner, who was Jackson's friend. Again, Gerald Turner specifically identifies Jackson as being the shooter. Joe Brown also testified that Jackson was not a character. He testified that he saw Jackson come to his house at 7:30 p.m. on the night of the shooting, and Jackson asked him if he could borrow his .40 caliber handgun. According to Brown, Jackson then returned back to his house roughly 45 minutes later, or approximately 8:15 p.m., returned the gun, changed his clothes, and apparently they boiled some rubber blue gloves that Jackson might have been wearing. Brown testified that Jackson admitted to him that he had shot RK. The third witness is
Before
Anthony.
You move on to the third witness, I wanted to ask you some questions about Mr. Brown. So he seemed to be the strongest witness as far as testifying on behalf of the state, but he was also a felon with three prior criminal convictions, and he could have been impeached on those grounds. But even more importantly, he was at the time indicted in federal court under the Armed Career Criminal Act, and he had reached a deal with federal prosecutors, right? He was going to get some consideration for testifying.
That's correct.
In this case.
Yes.
Right. And I mean, I could go through all of the other state's witnesses. I think each one of them were felons, except for CW, and she was not able to positively identify the defendant. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Although so the reason I'm going through this exercise with you is that what I read about the trial court's comments, basically the trial court was saying that the family members of the defendant had credibility issues because, of course, they'd have an incentive to lie for him.
Right.
But each of the state's witnesses did too, right? So we get into this weighing of credibility, and that is not what is supposed to happen at the stage of determining whether an evidentiary hearing should be held, right? Isn't the court supposed to take the facts alleged in the defendant's proffered affidavits of what the witnesses would have testified about as fact? And if indeed the court had done that, then the defendant couldn't have committed this crime, which entitles him to a Mockner hearing. What's your argument against that?
Well, right, and I agree with that 100%. I mean, they do take it at face value and assume that it is true. But in this particular, well, a couple of points, you know, as far as the witnesses are concerned, I don't believe that the witnesses that identified Jackson as being the shooter had any motive to lie about whether he did that. I mean, like I said, two of the witnesses that were against him were actually his friends, and one of the witnesses that implicitly implicates him in the shooting is his mother. The other thing I would say is the jury did hear that testimony. As far as the impeachment is concerned, there were, like you had mentioned, most of these witnesses at trial, except for CW and I think Carol, all had criminal convictions. But I think the point is, though the circuit court in this case was not looking at that information or, you know, with respect to whether or not these individuals had a motive to lie or provide him with an alibi witness or an alibi at least. In doing that, the court wasn't saying or finding that the affidavits were true or false or whether or not they were more credible, less credible than any of the other evidence that was presented at trial. It was simply engaging in the analysis that's required under Strickland, and that is taking the or analyzing the totality of the omitted evidence versus the totality of the evidence that was presented at trial and determine whether or not there was a reasonable probability of a different outcome.
But how could the court even do that? Because, of course, the two alibi witnesses were never called. So all the court had were the affidavits. There was nothing to assess the credibility of the witnesses the defendant wanted to call.
I agree, and the court shouldn't have assessed the credibility of those witnesses. I think, like I said, is what the court should have done and what I think the court did here was just acknowledge factors that could have impacted the credibility of those witnesses. Again, the court, in stating that both Marsh and Crystal had motives to provide Jackson with an alibi, the court was not finding that the contents of their alibis or the contents of their affidavits were false. The court also wasn't saying that these affidavits are more credible than the testimony of these witnesses who also had, you know, who may have had criminal convictions. Along those same lines, I think there's a host of number of other factors that the court could have and should have taken into consideration here. And that could be criminal convictions that either Crystal or Marsh had. We have no idea how many convictions that Marsh had, but we know that Crystal did have criminal convictions. I think the number is three. So I think the court in this case did not engage in weighing credibility here. In denying this, in denying the motion without a Mockner hearing, all the court did was did exactly what the court should have done. It engaged in the analysis that it was required to engage in under Strickland. It analyzed the totality of the admitted evidence versus the totality of the evidence that was presented at trial and determined that there was no reasonable probability that even taking those affidavits at face value, it wouldn't have made a difference.
So are you conceding that the defense attorney was deficient here?
I am not conceding that the defense attorney was deficient. In fact, I think that the motion was not sufficient to justify a Mockner hearing, like it was brought up before.
But in Strickland, you need to prove both prongs.
You
so
do need to prove.
We're addressing one.
Yeah, I think it's Baliete is, you know, a case on point. You need to prove both prongs, and my content or the contention is the Jackson did not prove both prongs in this case.
Let me ask you something. If I asked your friend on the other side some of these questions along this line. I think the record is pretty murky as to whether or not Marsh and Crystal were ever contacted by the defense attorney.
Okay? Right.
If Jackson's trial attorney said, we're going to put on three witnesses, Carol, Crystal, and Marsh, and the defense attorney never tried to contact Crystal or Marsh, and then they got to trial and only Carol testified, is that deficient?
Not necessarily, no. It's clear that a failure to engage in a full investigation does not automatically equate to deficient performance. And I don't agree that you necessarily have to talk to those witnesses in order to determine whether or not you need to call them.
Shouldn't there have been a hearing at least to figure that piece of it out, that is to figure out whether or not the defense attorney told Mr. Jackson, we're going to put three people on the stand, and now my attorney said we're going to put three people on the stand, we get to trial, and only Carol testifies.
I don't think that a hearing is required under those circumstances because that's only half the analysis. Prejudicial performance is only half the analysis here.
Are you saying as a matter of law, Strickland could never be proven and therefore we just move on to that step? I mean, I've had a number of Mockner hearings and also dealt with ineffective assistance a lot of times. Sometimes I'm surprised at what the lawyers say at the Mockner hearing. Sometimes I'm not. If the lawyer were to testify, hey, this was a judgment call, I did research into these people, and I decided not to call them because they were more of a liability than a benefit, mm-hmm. or the order of witnesses was my judgment call, and I decided this was the best way to present his case, it probably doesn't move on very far, does it? But the issue here is whether or not you even find out the answer to those questions.
Right, and I agree with that. I guess, and maybe I'm not understanding your point, but
my point is we're just dealing with whether or not there was enough here to say you should have the lawyer explain a few things.
Right, and yes, and I agree with that, but again, that doesn't justify a Mockner hearing because that's only half the analysis. In order to justify a Mockner hearing, the motion has to be sufficient and enough sufficient material facts that would justify the hearing unless the record conclusively shows that that individual or the defendant is not entitled to relief. And my point is, even assuming deficient performance in this case, the record shows that Jackson was not entitled to relief in this case because he can't show prejudice. There was no prejudice here.
But counsel, I mean, the defendant doesn't have to prove he didn't do it, right? All he has to do is convince one juror, or not even convince, just introduce reasonable doubt in one juror's mind. And it's the state's position that two more alibi witnesses to say he was at home and so couldn't have committed this crime, you're saying that couldn't possibly have introduced reasonable doubt in one juror's mind as a matter of law?
No, not as a matter of law. I'm saying based on the facts of this case, that is correct. I'm saying based on the facts of this case, there's no reasonable probability that had those two individuals, Crystal or Marsh, testified consistently with what their affidavits or what they say in their affidavits, it would have had there's no reasonable probability of a different outcome in this case.
And what's your argument on that score? Is it based on the fact that they didn't have eyes on him or conscious eyes on him at all points in time during the night, even though his girlfriend testified they went to bed and when she woke up, he was there by her?
No, I don't base it on that, although, like I said, I think that's a factor they could consider. What I'm mainly basing it on is the strength of the state's case. Again, we have five individuals, two of Jackson's friends and other individuals who placed Jackson outside of Jackson's home at the time this crime, or around the time this crime was committed.
But isn't that a credibility determination? I know you keep saying it isn't, but that's exactly when you have, you keep coming back to these are what these people said, so therefore it is so. The jury clearly believed those people, but the jury wasn't presented with other witnesses, and isn't it possible that the jury could believe other people? And aren't we really talking about credibility?
Well, I mean, I guess on a high level, you are talking about credibility when you're analyzing the, you know, the uncalled testimony versus the testimony. But you're not actually determining whether or not they're more or less credible than the evidence that was presented at trial.
Isn't that kind of what you're doing? You are determining that they're not credible. That's what I hear you saying. I hear you saying there's no way that even though these affidavits set forth this information, that these witnesses could be believed.
Well, that's a credibility determination. I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, I think that the jury could believe, and I'm assuming that the jury could believe the evidence or the statements that are contained in the affidavits, but that doesn't mean it has a reasonable probability of the of impact in the outcome at trial.
So you're saying, let me just hear you correctly. So you're conceding that they could be believed. So even if a jury were to believe Janika and Crystal, and they already heard from Carol, you're saying there's no way that, because those other witnesses were so convincing, that there's no way there could be another outcome to the trial?
I believe, first of all, when you're taking a look at that evidence against the other evidence, there is a credibility determination that's being made there, of course. Because like I said, you have five witnesses saying that Jackson was not at Carol's house between 7:30 and 8:30. These two individuals are saying, no, Jackson was there the entire time. So
it's five versus two?
Well, but there's other evidence that support the five witnesses, critical evidence that support the five witnesses saying that their version of events is correct. And, you know, again, these five individuals, and just to briefly go through the other two, it's Andre Dorsey and CW, of course, placed Jackson outside of Carol's home from 7:30 to 8:30. But importantly, all their testimony corroborates each other, including what time the shooting occurred. Now, again, Gerald testified.
Counsel, can I just jump in? I want to go back to the deficient performance real quickly. I heard you today not concede it. I didn't see you argue it. So what is exactly your, are you now making that argument I'm more concerned about the alibi witness piece than the other allegations of deficient performance.
Sure. I'm not conceding that the motion was sufficient. What needed to happen here was Jackson needed to overcome the presumption that there was adequate representation, that his attorney represented or was adequate. And that's just not here. There's no indication or there's no facts contained in that motion that overcome the presumption that Jackson received adequate representation. And without that, I would argue that you can't, that doesn't justify getting you to a Mockner hearing in this case.
Well, I mean, just straighten out the argument. Your opening argument to us was that the record conclusively showed that he was not entitled to relief. But you only get there, as you acknowledged to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, that if you conclude that he presented sufficient allegations that, if true, would entitle him to relief. So those can't be consistent. You could be alternative arguments, but if he did not engage in deficient performance, end of story. Right. You don't need to get any further than that. So are you making both arguments at the record that he didn't allege sufficient allegations because of the deficient performance prong, and even if he gets past that the record conclusively shows he's not entitled to relief on the prejudice prong? Is that your argument? Or what exactly is your argument to us?
Well, I would acknowledge that I didn't make that argument as far as the first issue is concerned. I would also point out, though, that this is a de novo review. And again, the motion did not allege, in my view, sufficient facts that overcome the presumption of adequate representation. But I do acknowledge that I didn't specifically raise that issue or address that issue in my first or that argument in my first.
I just want to explore the argument that Justice Dowlett was asking about a little bit as well on the deficient performance prong, right? We have some of this language, and I understand that the amici that we got talking about not doing credibility. The hard part, and I think you point this out, in cases that allege ineffective assistance of counsel, in order to be entitled to a hearing, you have to establish at least at some basic level prejudice, which seems to require some measure of credibility judgment, some measure of the assessment of the evidence, right? Because, listen, I mean, if the affidavits we got are true, I mean, I understand you made some arguments that they don't quite establish that, and I didn't be upfront. I didn't find those all that persuasive. I think that if these affidavits are true, then he's innocent. And so the only way that you win, given my assumption there, the only way that you win is arguing essentially that the jury just could not believe these because of the overwhelming evidence otherwise. And you make, I think, some very important points about the strength of the state's case. But there's a certain kind of weighing that's happening there, which puts us all in a little bit of a pickle, right? Because we have to, put ourselves in the eyes of a jury, which we do whenever we do kind of harmless error type analyses, but
right.
There's some judgment calls that have to be made there about what is believable and what's not believable.
Right, and I think that's an important point, but I think that's also an important distinction. The court in this case, the circuit court in this case, while pointing out facts that would negatively impact or potentially negatively impact the credibility of both Marsh and Crystal, didn't step into the shoes of the jury to say, I find these individuals to be incredible, or I find their testimony to be less credible. It did what it was supposed to do in weighing in engaging in the prejudice prong of Strickland, and that is assessing the totality of the evidence, of the omitted evidence, and assessing the totality of the evidence that was presented to the jury. And in this particular case, in order to believe Crystal and Marsh, you would have to disbelieve all the other evidence that was presented at trial. And I think that in and of itself, well, that is what the standard is. There's no reasonable probability in this case of a different outcome had those two individuals testified, even consistently with what's contained in their affidavits. I don't believe there's a reasonable probability, and that's what the standard is. It's not conceivable. It has to be a substantial likelihood that there would be some difference made here had these two individuals testified. And based on the strength of the evidence that the state put on at trial, I don't believe that had these two individuals testified, that would have made a difference. I would also say that had these two individuals testified, their testimony likely would have been more harmful than helpful as far as Jackson is concerned. Again, three individuals, Gerald Turner, Joe Brown, and Carroll, all testified that while RK and Turner were arguing, Tiffany's wife called Jackson and asked him to come help with the downstairs neighbor. Carroll explained that as a result of that phone call, there was such a heated argument between Jackson and Marsh that they essentially broke up after that, and she explained, that's the reason I can remember the details of this day even a year and a half later while she testified. Now, Crystal acknowledged in her affidavit that those two individuals were fighting. So the point is had Crystal and Marsh testified, there likely would have been five individuals who would have had to acknowledge that an hour before RK was shot, Gerald's wife, Tiffany, called RK and asked him to help with the downstairs neighbor. And if that was the case, the five individuals it's essentially a motive. If that's the case, those five individuals that would have testified to that would have consisted of two family members of Jackson, two personal friends of Jackson, and his girlfriend. Those are hardly adverse witnesses. So
that's all speculative, counsel. You don't know what they would have said at trial because, of course, they weren't called. We only know what they put in the affidavit, and we, as a court, have to accept that as true, and so did the circuit court.
Right, and I acknowledge that. All I'm saying is, based on an analysis of what's contained in those affidavits, along with an analysis of or an assessment of the evidence that was presented at trial, which is what's required in this case, I would argue that that's likely to happen. It wasn't just a small, you know, short argument. According to Carroll, this was a full-blown heated argument that resulted in these two individuals breaking up. And it, she also indicated that this is the entire reason she remembers the details of the day. So if these two individuals were in fact there, and we're assuming that they were, I would also assume that, like Carroll, she knew what the basis of the argument was about. And that was that an hour before RK was shot, Tiffany called Jackson and asked him to help with RK. And I think that I think that's a good reason to not call this.
But if he stayed in bed with his girlfriend, then he didn't really respond to the call for help.
Well,
that's the other version.
That's what those two individuals would testify to. And I would argue that there's no, even if they had testified to that, there's no reasonable probability of a different outcome in this case, given all the evidence that's stacked up against Jackson from the state, not only from the state's witnesses, but from Carroll. And that was the defense witness.
Counsel, I wrote Bentley in 1996, and I want you to tell me what I was thinking.
I would love to do that, Justin.
So, and carefully.
I said then that the court must grant a hearing if a movement's post-conviction motion alleges facts that, now I get to my point, if true, is implicit in that if true, if the jury finds it true?
Is implicit in the standard that the jury would find it true?
If true, who's the one that find, who are we talking to? Who's discerning the truth here? Is it the jury?
Well,
if
in a case,
home.
In a, well, yeah, I guess from my perspective, if I'm understanding your question correctly, a court in this particular case deciding whether or not to hold a Mockner hearing would assume that information to be true. Now, at a Mockner hearing, the court can make credibility determinations that go to the weight of whether or not, like in this case, whether or not Crystal or Marsh were credible as far as their affidavits are concerned. But that doesn't automatically justify a rehearing. I mean, that again, I think that's only half the analysis here. So even assuming that they are true, that what they're saying is true in this particular case, again, Crystal and Marsh's affidavits, that doesn't justify a Mockner hearing, because again, it's only half the analysis. If the record conclusively shows that they're not entitled to relief, then I see my time is up. If I could just finish my thought, he's not entitled to a Mockner hearing in this case because the record conclusively shows that he's not entitled to relief based on the fact that he can't establish prejudice under the Strickland prong.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors.
Mr. Bechtel, can I ask you, before we even start, to please respond to the state's argument about the reasonable probability that there would have been. They're saying even if Crystal and Marsha testified, there is not a reasonable probability that there would have been a different outcome. And the state lays out, they've got a lot of evidence. They really do. And they've got eyewitnesses. He didn't talk about the ballistics evidence. I think he probably got cut off. I think he would have. It certainly was in the Court of Appeals opinion and is in the record. Right, five bullets are missing, five bullet casings, the same gun, blah, blah, you know, all of that is corroborating. There's corroborating witnesses, the timing, all of that. So what's wrong with their argument, if anything?
I think there is plenty wrong with it. Look, I'm a bearer of simple mind here, and I keep coming back to the fact that these witnesses are telling the truth, then Jackson is not guilty. And that ultimately, yeah, there was ballistic evidence, but the ballistics expert didn't say that Jackson was holding the gun. Joe Brown said Jackson was holding the gun. There was DNA taken off the gun, but they couldn't get a profile in which to make an identification. We have no real physical evidence that puts that gun into Larry Jackson's hand. The only evidence we have to put it into his hand are the state's witnesses. Now, those are, most importantly, Joe Brown and Gerald Tucker and Andre Dorsey. Because CW does not ever make an actual positive identification. He says he looks potentially like the person. Now, we got three witnesses. My client tells me he gave these three names to his trial attorney. The trial attorney did file a notice of alibi listing those three witnesses.
What I hear you saying is you're really focused when it comes to the Machner hearing. And I think most Machner hearings are focused on the deficient performance prong. And you just want to explore that further. Were there any reasons why these witnesses weren't called? If there are, and the lawyer made a calculated decision, it's not ineffective assistance, right?
I'm in a tough spot. I have to, I think I was looking up, if I recall, counsel has a State v. Domke, I think it's cited in the brief. Counsel has a duty to make reasonable investigations or make strategic investigation unnecessary. So I would have to be able to argue that, well, you needed to do some further investigation. I'm in a tough spot, though, because even Strickland says that a decision not to call a witness is virtually unassailable.
And the order of witnesses?
And the order of witnesses, I think we have to hear what exactly did the trial counsel say to Jackson. What does she say was said? And it would be nice.
But is that his call or her call?
The order. I think it's his call. I think
the order of witnesses?
Well, the decision to testify is his call.
Correct.
And if
with
I
the
recall,
advice of counsel.
Yeah, and I think Brooks states that that involved a statute, which said that the defendant had to testify first, and they said that that denied the defendant the guiding hand of counsel, I think is the exact phrase they used in Brooks. There's some other cases, they're cited in the brief, which actually apply to situations. Since I read the law, a court can't require a defendant to testify first unless there's some reason for it. The trial judge still has command of his courtroom.
Well, the record doesn't show that the trial judge ever said that.
No, the record doesn't show that. And in the order by the trial court, he doesn't really address that and say, well, I never said anything like that anyways. I figure that that's why I did it as ineffective assistance. If I had reason to believe or something to back up that the trial judge really said that, and all I have is my client telling me this, you know. My client telling me that his attorney told him this.
Machner hearings really go to the deficient performance prong,
yes.
Not the prejudice prong.
But I do think there is prejudice, because it does put him in.
I understand what you're saying, but the answer to that is?
The answer is that the prejudice would be that.
No, the deficient performance is really what you want to get at. Did
yes,
the lawyer
yes.
have reasons for what yeah. the lawyer did?
Yeah, I think that really actually that issue in and of itself is probably reason enough to say let's have a Machner hearing, because we haven't heard from the trial counsel. We don't have Jackson's testimony. We don't have Jackson's father's testimony. And we don't really have the trial court's input on what happened there. If there was some reason why he could not go first, like there are cases out there that say if witnesses are unavailable, then making the defendant testify is not a violation of, but there's no evidence that was the case here. His one witness was there, you know, Carol Jackson, and she testified. I'm out of time. I'm sorry.
It goes fast. Thank you for your arguments in this case. We will adjourn and reconvene when counsel for the next case are ready.